You ready to go?
Okay, thank you. Welcome back, everyone. So this is session 9, and we've been doing this Hot Topics Roundup for a couple of years at Private Business Tax Retreat. And what we try to achieve in this session is just to do a snapshot of some kind of key topics that have been coming up in the last sort of, you know, 6 to 12 months. So without going into full detail, we just give everyone a bit of a, you know, short, sharp update on these topics. This morning we're going to be hearing from Bruce Collins from Tax Controversy Partners in respect of the latest developments in ATO debt strategies. And we're going to be hearing from Billy Jo Femlonga from Femlonga Business Services in relation to Payday Super, What You Didn't Know. And then rounding it out will be Jenny Lynn from the Australian Taxation Office in relation to From One Generation to the Next, the tax side of succession. So I will hand over to Bruce.
Well, it's amazing when someone claps when you're going to talk about ATO debt. We've got a bunch of slides, I expect that people might take these away and read them. I'm not going to go through everything in depth. There's also a technical paper for a short half-hour session. But there's a lot of things happening in the debt space. And I just want to preface this by a recognition that the ATO's job in collecting debts owed to the Commonwealth is actually a very difficult one. But as they say, with great power comes great responsibility. So the powers that they have to enforce debts are the ones that every creditor has, plus a range of statutory powers that the Commissioner has specifically given by Parliament to get them to be able to collect the money that is owed to Commonwealth coffers. So they do have great power, and they do have responsibilities that come with that. So we've all seen that the ATO debt machine is cranked up, and that as a result there's a range of effects that has. So we see that there's an increased pressure on taxpayers, especially small business operators, to try to pay debts. And if the ATO doesn't like the engagement with the client, they're likely to take enforcement action of various kinds. Now, we'll talk about the ATO vulnerability framework. We'll talk about the debt concessional principles consultation. We'll talk about the ATO's GIC, General Interest Charge, remission guidelines, and their latest guidance that came out on the 22nd of January. We'll talk about the a review of interest charge remission that is currently underway by the Tax Ombudsman. And then we'll talk about the Treasury consultation on legislative changes and administrative changes in relation to coerced directorships. And we're going to do that in half an hour. So off we go. So I just said all of that. There's a lot of feedback from practitioners about what you're experiencing, what we are experiencing, and what taxpayers are experiencing with the ATO debt machine. Now, the pushback from the industry perspective is that the ATO talk about having a degree of flexibility and discretion and responding empathically to taxpayers' circumstances. But that isn't always the experience that people get when they're on the other side of the ATO's debt actions. Now, I can understand, because I worked for the ATO for 35 and a half years, I understand what their philosophy is and what their role is. The trouble is that when you've got taxpayers with varying circumstances, it's important that those circumstances are properly taken into account by the decision makers on the other side of the fence. And sometimes they're just ticking the boxes, and sometimes they're not listening to what's happening, and sometimes they're substituting their judgment for the perspective of experts, particularly for vulnerable taxpayers. So the vulnerability framework is the ATO's strategic response to try to recognise that they have a role in recognising the circumstances of taxpayers that take them out of the norm, that mean that they have some degree of vulnerability that means that they should be treated differently in the application of ATO powers, especially debt collection and lodgement enforcement powers. Now, if you think about the forms of vulnerability that people have, they include things like being affected by bushfires or floods. The ATO deals pretty well with those sorts of circumstances, but they also include people that might be from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, people who might not speak English as first language, who may have very different cultural settings and expectations, and they don't engage well with the tax system or the superannuation system. So the vulnerability framework is trying to recognise those aspects. And then you get people that are mentally ill, physically ill, and people who have potentially been subject to things like family violence or coercive control. And those people have different experiences with life as a result of those illnesses or those personal experiences of abuse. And as a consequence, they will have different problems with interacting with the tax system. And the ATO does not deal well, in my experience on both sides of the fence, with the issues for taxpayers who are physically ill, mentally ill, or have been the subject of domestic violence or coercive control, financial abuse, basically. So the ATO have developed the vulnerability framework. The first draft of that was very much, we recognise that people have these problems and we will refer them to services that can help them, and we'll continue to push the buttons on our debt machine. And I'm being blunt with my assessment of what that looked like. The vulnerability framework responded to some degree to the feedback from industry, including from the Tax Institute and other professional bodies, and also advocacy groups for people suffering from domestic violence in particular. And they have made some changes, and it is an improvement on what was originally contemplated, but it's still only part of the way there. And there's a further round of consultation on elements in the vulnerability framework, which is forthcoming. They're going to be having some consultation on issues in March and another set in June this year, according to the ATO's consultation listings at the moment. Now, the sorts of things that people encounter in the vulnerability framework context are, if you tell the tax office that the taxpayers have a form of vulnerability, the tax officers may not believe you. What evidence is sufficient to actually explain and convince an ATO sceptic that the person actually is physically ill, that they have suffered a mental health breakdown, that they are subject to domestic violence or financial abuse? Because you can understand the Commissioner's position. The Commissioner's sitting there and they have to administer things, and people could be using false defences to say why they couldn't pay or why they weren't actually responsible for these actions in particular. So they take it with a grain of salt. But if they come along with a pound of salt and maybe a truckload of salt behind them and they won't actually accept the evidence that they see before them, that's a problem. So it's a question about how much evidence is reasonable and how the ATO officers who are dealing with these cases are going to actually review that evidence and accept it where it's reasonable to do so. So the vulnerability framework is a work in progress, and I think that there needs to be a great deal more input from the profession and feedback from practitioners through professional bodies, including through the Tax Institute, on what your practical experience is in dealing with those issues. We certainly provide a lot of that feedback from our firm's perspective. Now, the guiding principles are equity and fairness, considering individual circumstances, accessibility and inclusion in the design and delivery of services, empathy and compassion, transparency and accountability, privacy and data security, particularly, by the way, privacy and data security to protect victims of domestic violence or other forms of financial abuse, and continuing to improve by responding to changed needs and expectations. Now, they're all nice principles, but what they don't do is necessarily help with the decisions on individual cases, and that's where the rubber hits the road. Now, the core focus areas for the ATO's further work are improving their support, are looking at the services that they can actually deploy, and looking at the design of their processes and practices, and then training their staff and potentially having special staff in some areas dealing with these issues. Now, the outstanding issues, as I said, are the ones around it doesn't provide specific guidance to ATO staff on what to do in the most common types of circumstances. So it doesn't say, if you've got a person who claims to have a physical health condition, what medical evidence should they provide and how will we evaluate it? It doesn't say, if you get a person who claims to be a victim of domestic violence, that means that they were unable to pay or in fact may not even have been involved as a director. We'll talk about coerced directorships in a moment in the legislative design context. But those sorts of things that people may raise doesn't tell the ATO staff actually how to do it, and it doesn't actually consider the guidance on the application of the existing discretions within the law. things like the GIC remission power, things like the ability to accept offences for director penalty notices, where there is power in the existing framework for the ATO debt people in frontline compliance to make decisions. It needs to give that guidance to those staff so that they actually are better able to function. It also, like, if you think about the debt area, frontline compliance and the other parts of the ATO that deal with debt and lodgement issues, there's hundreds to thousands of people in those areas. Not all of them need to be experts in dealing with particular types of domestic violence contexts or mental health problems. We don't expect them all to turn into psychologists and counsellors. We do expect that some of them will actually understand enough about those issues to help with people that are in genuinely dire, vulnerable circumstances. And there is a very small pipeline with a few people in the ATO that deal with financial counsellors who provide support to domestic violence victims to help them to clear up their tax record and separate from the abuser. But the majority of the people in the frontline context don't actually have those skills or abilities or specific knowledge. And identifying when somebody is claiming that they've got various forms of vulnerability and then piping the work to people that have the requisite skills, knowledge and experience is something that I think the ATO needs to continue to work on. And there are some positive signs which we'll talk about in that direction, but there's a hell of a lot of room for improvement in from the perspective of practitioners' feedback. Now, they are looking at all of those issues in terms of the financial abuse work that came from the Tax Ombudsman's excellent report on dealing with financial abuse in the tax system. The financial coercion and domestic abuse thing is one of my hot topics. I'm a bit of a soapbox advocate for the ATO dealing better with those issues and indeed other government agencies like ASIC as well. But there's much work still to be done, but we are seeing steps, baby steps maybe so far, in the right direction. Now, another thing that the ATO is trying to do is to provide some of that guidance on the application of their debt concessions. Now, what's a debt concession? I don't think they're concessions, I think they're discretions. Viewing them as concessions makes them sound like they're something that the ATO can decide not to apply. The ATO has initiated a review of their discretion to accept payment plans, are looking at payment deferrals, and are looking at the remission of GIC and failure to lodge penalties. And the first part of that work is already starting to hit the road with the next item we're going to talk about. But the big issue is that the ATO is partway through a journey of cultural change. Now, I think that Bruce Bilson made a good point yesterday morning in his Q&A. He mentioned that the role of the Commissioner is seen to be to raise revenue for government, and I made that point at the outset today. But what we have is that there's a challenge to do that in a sensitive way that actually promotes voluntary compliance or engagement as willing participants in the tax system. You don't hear the ATO talking about willing participation or voluntary compliance the way that they used to. And some of these debt concessional powers and the principles the ATO has articulated need to deal with the underlying impact that the overly harsh strategies they might deploy would otherwise have on the taxpaying community and the practitioners that support them. So the idea is that the ATO is trying to make things more obvious. They're trying to extrovert the thinking that goes on behind closed doors. Now, the original sorts of principles that they put forward were fairness, but fairness to whom? Is it fairness to the taxpaying community that voluntarily pay because they can? Or is it fairness to the people who are actually faced with a barrier that prevents them being able to pay? Now, if you think about a reasonable person test, the reasonable person test focuses on an objective test applied in the subjective circumstances of the taxpayer. So if they talk about fairness and reasonableness, are they actually talking about fairness to everybody else who paid, which is where they sit at the moment? The ATO's philosophy is very much on that setting. Or should they be thinking about fairness to people who are in similar circumstances up to the person who was unable to pay because of things that happened to them. And this is the challenge. Conditionality. You don't need to apply a concession where a person has a bad compliance record. So this is a strange one, because if a person can't pay and they don't pay for a while because they actually have a problem that prevents them paying, or they don't lodge, then the condition which was in the original draft of these principles would actually say that you don't get the exercise of the discretion that's only necessary because you couldn't pay. And again, that seems wrong-headed, illogical, circular in its reasoning. That they need to consider the context of the taxpayer, but also the context in the system. And again, the context of the taxpayer is a good thing, considering subjective circumstances, but it doesn't necessarily give rise to the question about what the comparison should be with the rest of the population. And engagement, the degree of engagement that the ATO has with the taxpayer. If you've got somebody that's suffering from a mental health crisis that can't actually get out of bed because they're suffering from clinical depression, or a person is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, and every time they think about tax, they fall further and further into the fugue state of their disorder, they're not going to engage with the tax office. And these principles would say that a person who hasn't made an effort to deal with the ATO will not get the benefit of the concession that they might deserve if you truly considered their circumstances. And that degree of engagement that the ATO expects, if you come to them early and engage with them often, they'll give you a better ride with these concessions. That may not be the most applicable standard to hold people against when they might have good reasons why they didn't engage. And exclusions are for people that might be, for instance, accused of things that the ATO rates as high risk. So if you've got somebody who's been involved in what is perceived to be a tax avoidance scheme, the ATO may not choose to give them a debt concession when actually if they're right about their position, which might be reasonably arguable on one level, perhaps the ATO should revisit whether they get that concession or not. The feedback was that there needed to be some extra principles. The Tax Institute and the Law Council effectively suggested things like there should be greater consistency. So if husband and wife puts two things in, they should both be treated equally, favourably. There should be transparency. There should be greater visibility about what people are doing and why. There needs to be flexibility in terms of not just applying an arbitrary rule to fetter the administrative discretions that the Commissioner has, that the guidelines that the ATO provides to its staff should not be seen as being ring fences that constrain the exercise of those discretions. That there should be a greater role and recognition of the role of agents as verifiers of the circumstances of taxpayers. And we should be believed as practitioners, whether as a tax agent or a tax lawyer or whomever, because we've actually vetted the circumstances and we're putting our ticket on the line by saying this is the proposition that the taxpayer has. Vulnerability, again, is my hottest topic. My soapbox is really that the ATO does not deal well with vulnerable taxpayers. And there's an interaction between these concessional principles that guide the exercise of those powers with the vulnerability framework stuff I've already whacked on about for a while. Now, the ATO, on the 22nd of January this year, released as a response to a range of feedback, including on the debt concession principle consultation, and also from the vulnerability framework, a set of examples of what the circumstances would be where a GIC request would be likely to be accepted and the ones where they would not. Now, I do agree with all the ones which they say would be acceptable. I'm not sure that I agree with all of the ones that they say shouldn't. And I'll focus on the ones that are possibly negative and why I think there's a bit of criticism available for those. So adverse business conditions that affect cash flow that are generally applicable in the economy. The first two points, they say that if you have COVID, for instance, I'm sure people have heard this, but if you apply for something and say your client was unable to cope because of the fact that they were affected by the economic downturn during COVID, the ATO is now saying that that affected everybody in the economy, so you don't deserve the application of GIC remission. If you show that you suffered specific damage from things that affected you in particular, you're on the left-hand side and maybe you can succeed in getting a GIC remission. But if you just say that I was generally affected by something that affected my business as part of the broader economy, or even a sector of the economy like the building industry, they say no. I'm not sure that that's appropriate. Because you look at the fact that if you've got two taxpayers who have, one is cash rich and has a lot of resources, they will be affected by an economic downturn and still have the ability to pay their tax debts. If you get somebody who was running on very tight margins, was maybe starting up a business, or was simply had a bad run of other circumstances, they don't have that depth of resource. And here they're saying because the downturn affected everybody, nobody gets the benefit of the concession, when there might be other circumstances that would justify it. They've got general business risks, such as a trend of late payment as opposed to a specific failure of a particular business debtor. By the way, it says by a creditor, by the way, in the ATO material it should be debtor, but that's up to them. And expanding your business to invest in it while not paying your tax obligations. Well, many times the ATO sees the continuation of your business and the expenditure you place on it as being continued investment. If you're a property developer and you stop buying land to develop your properties, maybe you've got options on those properties that say that you're supposed to pay, and you use borrowed funds, the ATO says, well, you've just spent $2 million buying a property, therefore you've expanded your business instead of paying that $2 million to the ATO. The difficulty with that is that they haven't necessarily considered the converse, that you had an option which you would lose money on if you didn't exercise it, and you were borrowing the rest of the funds. So maybe out of the $2 million, you were only really putting in $200,000 or $300,000 of your own money. And so that's the stuff where the ATO needs to, I think, rethink their settings. Now, the process is somewhat better than it was. It's now going to a special area. Agents have the option of using the online form. Tax lawyers don't. Tax lawyers are now reduced to ringing up on the phone or sending snail mail. It really is like the 1950s in that sense. There still needs to be a channel for lawyers, by the way, to communicate with the ATO, but that's a battle for another day. But the online services gateway with a specific form will pipe you through to an area in frontline compliance that now specialises in dealing with GIC remissions and failure to lodge penalty remissions. Now, you can also make a phone call and sit on their queue, the online form is obviously best for tax agents. And you have to use the form. If you don't use the form, they'll actually send it back, which is crazy. But there's no specified legislative basis for them designating a form needs to be completed, but they are, in fact, pushing back on practitioners, I hear, when they don't use the form. We lodged one this morning, and we had to do that because we put the form in, but we knew it was required. Now, the application form, I just said all of that, so I'm not going to read it. There's a review of ATO interest charge remission by the Tax Ombudsman. Is it a coincidence that the ATO has introduced this range of things like the vulnerability framework, the debt concession guidance, and the new examples and the new online form while the Tax Ombudsman is doing a review of their existing processes? Probably not. I think it's a preemptive attempt by the ATO to get ahead of the likely criticism will come from practitioners about what they were doing up to now. It's also recognition that there was room for improvement and they're taking that step. Now, there is one thing that is not covered by anything the ATO has done so far, which is very much a focus in the Tax Ombudsman's review by my conversations with the Ombudsman's staff and the Ombudsman herself, which is really around the refusal to preemptively agree to remit GIC as a condition for a payment plan. At the moment, the ATO says, we'll negotiate a payment plan, including you paying the GIC, and then at the end, we'll consider whether we will remit. And often that means the difference between a payment plan being possible or a payment by borrowing being possible versus not being possible. Because if the GIC is factored in, maybe the person can't pay. But if the GIC were remitted, they could get the money tomorrow, or maybe pay it over a year, which would be a reasonable payment plan period. But that's something I think that the ATO still needs to really consider. You get the occasional debt person in frontline compliance who will negotiate on that, but mostly their policy is not. Now, the Treasury consultation on coerced directorship is the last thing I want to talk about, really. I've mentioned financial abuse and the problems that exist for people who are the victims of financial abuse by usually a domestic partner. It's also something that happens, by the way, with elder abuse and other family relationships where other relatives get drawn into an abuser's financial machinations. But what we find is that there's usually a perpetrator who is getting a victim involved in their financial affairs, whether as a coerced director, as is in the case here, or more broadly. Now, a coerced director can actually be appointed fraudulently. In other words, I get somebody to become a director by forging a form, then I get the ASIC agent to lodge that form with the ASIC on the basis that it's real. Now, there's a danger for all of us as practitioners from taking instruction from one family member and assuming that what they give you is accurate. And it's very important to try to take instructions from the person who is actually supposedly signing the form before you actually register somebody as an ASIC agent or indeed in lodging tax forms and statements. Now, fraudulent appointments mean that if the person proves that it wasn't their signature, that they didn't authorise themselves from being put on the register, they can escape liability because ASIC will take them off the register if they provide proof that they didn't consent. And that is actually a good thing. ASIC are improving their internal processes to deal with that. But there's also coerced appointments where somebody is actually under duress and they're pushed into becoming a director by that duress. Now, that is often done as a result of threats of violence or psychological abuse. And in those circumstances, it's a bit more difficult. They're obviously on the register, they obviously signed the form, and there'll be liability for them as directors for insolvent trading under 588G, the Corps Act. There'll also be liability for director penalties under Subdivision 269 in Schedule 1 of the Tax Administration Act. Now, those circumstances, the current defences for both insolvent trading and the defences for director penalties don't deal well with this idea of duress. But there's also the person who is subject to deception. They're told everything is fine. They're told you're a director, you might have already been a director or you're appointed as a director, and then the abuser is the one who's managing the finances. This can be done by charm. Some of the most charming rogues are engaged in these forms of abuse. So the idea here is that deception may go on for an indefinite period of time until things go wrong. Now, in the Corporations Act, there's a specific defence for reliance upon advice, a reasonable reliance on advice from another person in your duties as a director. There's nothing like that. It's consciously excluded from the DPN regime. So the Treasury consultation really talks about, might have actually gone on ahead too far there, but it talks about changing the Corps Act to provide specific defences for domestic violence, coercive control situations. It also talks about making specific changes in the director penalty notice context as well. There's also a suggestion in some of the feedback, including some of the ones that I was involved in writing, that maybe they should think about making the perpetrator primarily liable as a shadow director presumptively, unless they can prove they weren't. But the big issue is providing effective defences for the people who are engaged in those forms of abuse so that they get a defence. Now, I go back to my point about the vulnerability framework. The evidence that people provide is not specified anywhere. So one of the things that the feedback from some of the consultation commentators was that there needed to be something in the legislative mix that actually specifies if you get two people who are professionals to say that there was family violence and domestic abuse, coercive control, then that should suffice to force agencies, including ASIC and the ATO, to accept such evidence in circumstances where it would be reasonable to do so. Now, the big question for us as practitioners is that there's a lot of things happening, there's a lot of pieces moving through this market. The ATO's role is a difficult one. They deal with hundreds of thousands to millions of decisions of these kinds a year, and they need to be operating the machine in a way which is sensitive to the needs of people that have different requirements and operate in different circumstances. Now, the ATO is obviously subject to the law as it exists. One of the things that the vulnerability framework now contemplates is that they'll also recommend law changes, whereas previously it just said we'll take the law as we find it and there's very little we can do. But there's going to need to be a push from practitioners and our bodies like the Tax Institute to encourage people to actually consider legislative change and policy changes from an administrative perspective in the ATO. So I've got 24 seconds to introduce Billy Joe. So thank you very much, everyone, and hopefully that was thought-provoking. The paper's there and the PowerPoint presentation's there as well, so if you'd like to make your way up.
Thank you, everyone, and good morning. It's lovely to see you all here this morning. Now, payday super, there's a lot to cover and 30 minutes, so bear with me while I get through all of this. And if you did have any questions, please feel free to accost me at lunch or afternoon tea and I can do my best. So I just wanted to talk about all the recent changes that are coming up. Now, I'm sure you're all aware that we've got payday super coming in on 1 July. Now, I think traditionally we've sort of taken a bit of a view that that's a bookkeeping issue, it's a payroll issue, is it really a tax issue? I understand that approach, but looking into it more deeply, there's a lot of different tax issues that are going to come out of this, and it's very important that we become aware of what issues are arising. Now, the core changes is that we've got 7 days to have super cleared. Now, this is not just you've clicked the button, it's paid, it's gone off, now all your responsibility is gone. Under the new legislation, the super actually has to be cleared with the fund and in the member's account within 7 days of the payroll date. Now, I'm sure as many of you know that the software providers in the current state of play, we're probably looking at 4-5 days processing time just to get it into the fund, let alone before it makes it to the member's account. Sometimes this can be 7 days, 2 weeks. This is a real issue that we're going to be facing over the next few months. So today I'm just going to talk a little bit about operational changes, timing, changes to ECC, super guarantee charges, and how you can prepare for these changes. So, super needs to be lodged at the same time that you process the wages. The issue that we have here is probably about the timing of payroll. Traditionally, we've got weekly, we've got fortnightly, monthly payrolls, and it's usually indicated by the employer what date you want to pay, Monday, Tuesday, Friday. Under the new rules, there's a little bit of difference in the timing of that. So traditionally, with the old super, you get 28 days after the end of the quarter or the month, depending on whether you're doing monthly or quarterly reporting, which provides us with a nice little block of time to carry everything. Now, with the 7 days, I'm just going to flip over here to this slide. If you're paying on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday or Thursday, it's effectively giving you 9 processing days. So while 7 business days, you get a nice little weekend in there, so you'll get 9 days. There is the idea going around at the moment that if you change your payroll date to Friday, you're going to get 11 days, which is a bonus weekend. Now, I don't know about you, but who's going to be paying their payroll to work over the weekend to make sure their payroll is going to get processed within 7 days? The larger companies, I understand that they've probably got external providers, even remote, but for most majority of small businesses, requesting bookkeepers to work weekends and things like that, it's just not an option. So when we see all this guidance coming around asking you if you should be changing your payroll date, just keep that in mind. Are you changing it to risk compliance, but the cost will cost you a lot more just to administer that? The other thing that we have here is that changing your payroll date, there's an issue with your employees. Your employees don't like change. They never do. You change it from Monday to Tuesday, there's going to be people that object. These things are going to take time to implement. So again, I'm just a reminder that you shouldn't be leaving it to the last minute, and it's really something that you need to be making your clients aware of, and they need to be thinking about now. Now, sorry. One of the biggest issues that we're going to face is whether software providers are going to be ready. Now, the government announced this in the 2024 budget. It wasn't legislated until November last year. Now, naturally, all of our large software providers, they were not about to spend millions of dollars developing a system that they didn't have guidance for as to what the exact rules were going to be. So, zero standards, all of those above, they only started developing in November once they got the guidance. Now, I don't know if you're all aware, but developing multi-million dollar software platforms is not quick, not easy. There's a huge question surrounding whether the software will actually be ready for 1 July. The main issue being is that the responsibility has now shifted. As I said, no longer is it your responsibility, just click the button, you've met all your obligations. If the super has not arrived in the member's account within 7 days, you are responsible for that as the employer. So the question becomes is, well, how do we know? How do we get it there? My understanding is that the new software, well, the new development of all the existing payroll softwares will have essentially a dashboard so you as the employer can see it's arrived at that employee's fund at this date, at this time, which will give you the assurance that you've met your obligations. But genuinely, I just don't know how we're going to see that ready for 1 July. It will be interesting. At the same time, we're also going to have the decommissioning of the ATO clearinghouse. Now, I know that most software providers have this built in, but the clearinghouse is used by 250,000 small businesses. One of the key indicators that I see people using the clearinghouse over the in-house software is because it's a lot easier to manage contractors as well as opposed to just employees. Not all software is built the same, and a lot of the payroll softwares are not necessarily built to handle contractors that attract super. So the clearinghouse has traditionally been a really great resource for the small businesses to use the to be able to process this. This will disappear on 1 July. So it's very important that those that are using the clearinghouse are advising their clients they need to get software, and they're going to have it. I also wonder, there's currently under the STP rules, there is a carve out for people who are remote, very elderly, and cannot access internet and online services. So they can apply for a grace under this so that they can process in other manners. Now, under the new rules for the Payday Super, there is no grace. So there's no concessions, you can't apply for anything. And I just wonder how that is going to impact our, as I say, those with remote, those with no internet, the seniors who can't use the technology. It's really important that we're addressing that with our clients at the moment as to whether they're going to be prepared for this. So just talking a little about transition planning, there's a lot of guidance at the moment. Daniel Butler has written a two-series article over the last two tax vine, which covers a lot of this in detail, so I'm not going to go into it. We're also having a special webinar series free for members in a week and a half, which will cover a lot of this in more detail, so if you're interested, please come along. But the important part is that we need to start be planning and transitioning now. We've only got 3 months, so we need to get organised. One of the other issues is rejected contributions. So at the moment, there's no actual formal process for rejected contributions. I mean, I'm not sure if you're familiar, but sometimes the new employee, wrong TFNs, wrong details, you'll submit your superannuation. You might actually not see that rejected until sort of 6-7 weeks later, some of it. You might just get a random amount appear in your bank account and it's, what's that? There's no formal statement from the super saying we've rejected it for these reasons. Some funds do, but the majority don't have these actual formal processes in place. Under the new rules, the super funds have 3 business days to return rejected super. Again, the ATO guidance says that everyone, all the complying funds, need to be ready for this, but I'm just concerned about logistically how that's actually going to be possible before 1 July. Do the funds have the capacity to process these rejections within 3 business days? From a rejected point, once it comes back to us, we then again have 14 days to correct it and send it back. Now, without the communication methods and quality and monitoring controls, we might not necessarily know that it's come back, or the client might not see it. Particularly those on the small business side who might do bookkeeping fortnightly. So they get a small business and they have a bookkeeper come in, you know, once a fortnight, once like that. Are they going to see it within 3 days in action? And so I also wonder about the compliance burden and cost to small businesses, and they will need to put steps in place for more regular monitoring. We just covered that one. Now, increased compliance. So we are going. Some people are going to go from 4 to 52 super payments a year. We can all expect more compliance. We're going to have greater reliance on automated systems. So for small employees, that's fine. They're not very complex. But for large employees that have got hundreds, thousands of employees, multiple awards, there is a lot to consider. I just want to touch on the ECC limits. So I don't know if everyone's aware, but the ECC limits are going to be increasing. So we've got 32,500 from 26-27. And the reason that that's important is because I'm just going to show you an example here. Now, under the current system, if you're paying quarterly at the moment, you can expect that come this July, we're going to have a quarterly payment covering April to June. However, you're going to end up doubling up if we have to start doing monthly contributions from July. So as you can see in 2026-2027, if you end up with the final quarter payment plus 12 monthly payments for Mrs. Bean Counter on $250,000, they're going to end up with an excess contribution in 2027. I have seen recently guidance that said, well, everyone should go out and make sure that this quarter for April to June, they should pay it before the end of the year so this doesn't happen. I disagree with that a little, because you're still going to end up with having 5 quarterly payments in 2026. I also wouldn't run out and be too hasty to do that. So this issue was raised this week with Treasury, and whilst there's not formal guidance on it, they have acknowledged that it's an issue. And they've agreed to put in some concessions. Now, these concessions, again, they're not here yet, but it is said that it could potentially only apply to 26-27. So if you go run out and prepay your June quarter now, in April to June, and then you've got an ECC problem in 2026 year, you might not actually get the concession that is brought out in the next few months. So my advice is actually just to hold off on that and not be a bit too hasty, and just wait for Treasury to give a little bit more guidance in the next few months. Now, super guarantee, this is going to change. At the moment, we've got our super guarantee statements, which we would lodge. You will no longer lodge those in their traditional form. It will now be replaced by a voluntary disclosure and approved form. Now, the ATO actually hasn't issued any guidance on that, so we don't actually know what that approved form will look like. I'm sure that will be released in the coming month, ready for 1 July, but it is something to make sure that you're looking out for. There is also a new calculation method for administrative components. So there's a 60% uplift where you don't make a voluntary disclosure. So currently, you might see in practice, late payers of super, they sort of stick their head in the sand. They'll be like, okay, well, if the ATO comes along and throws a super guarantee at me, we'll deal with it then. The penalties are the same. Then now whether I voluntary disclose. Under the new rules, it's a 60% uplift if you don't voluntary disclose. So if the ATO comes to you in a year's time and says, well, you haven't lodged, it's going to be a lot worse off for you. So under the new rules, it is better to voluntary disclose, even if you are late, to reduce those penalties. Now, the ATO has also provided guidance in PCD 2026-1, which came out about 3 or 4 weeks ago. This sort of sets out their compliance approach to these new rules within the next sort of 12 months, 24 months of the transition period. You can go and have a look at this yourself for PCG, but I do have a little bit of a slide here with the risk zones. So the PCG also sets out the three different zones, your low, your medium, your high. On the face of it, it does seem complex, but I mean, you go through it in great detail. It says that their main focus is on the high risk. And high risk is just those that don't comply. They don't lodge at all. They're not lodging super. They're not paying. They're completely disregarding. Your medium is going to be essentially you're paying super, but they're still doing it on sort of a quarterly fashion. The traditional, they're not making steps to move towards payday super, and that's sort of your medium risk zone. Your lower risk zone is going to be those that are making steps to comply. So they're taking efforts. You might be 1 or 2 days out, but at the end of the day, you're making efforts to comply, so it won't attract as much attention. So we won't have cause to review. So as long as you're trying, you should be fine. So just talking about the transition strategy, it's really important that we're getting our employers telling our clients that they need to be reviewing payroll cycles, assessing clearinghouse processing times. And I say that because there's a lot of different software providers. A lot of small businesses use your low-end providers, your low-cost providers, and I don't know if you've used those, but the clearing times can sometimes be a lot longer than your bigger providers. So it's very important that the clients are actually looking at their providers and making sure that their provider is going to be up to scratch for this new regime. Implementing internal monitoring, as I said, fortnightly bookkeeper is no longer going to be satisfactory, or monthly bookkeeper to look at the bank to see if there's a rejected or returned super. It's going to require more constant monitoring from that perspective. Communicating with employees and salary sacrifice risk. Now, I find with the quarterly and even the monthly, because of the delay of super processing at year end, you know, we get all those notices. Make sure you have your final contributions in by 15th of June, 20th of June at the latest. It does provide us as agents a little bit more flexibility to give guidance as to super contribution and contribution planning, because we sort of know that there won't be any more contributions until July for quarterly. In this regard, it's going to be a lot difficult for us. So if we get into real-time super payday, you could have employers paying super and super landing on 28th, 29th of June. And that's going to make it difficult for super planning, to tax planning, if you are considering additional contributions, things like that. And I just think it's going to make it quite a tighter time frame for this planning. So it's just something to be mindful of. I can't see it happening right now in this year, but as the real-time super does become more relevant, it is going to be important for us to be thinking about that, because, you know, one extra pay might put you over the contribution cap for the year and then you've got problems. Just a little guideline as to what I think in getting your clients just to do an audit, plan their development, build, and more importantly, testing. Test this before we get to July. There's no point setting everything up, getting to July, and then working out it doesn't work. Get it in place now, start testing it, make sure the timing is working, particularly for larger employers. A few key takeaways on this. The timing risk is the big one. there is a lot of discussion about this, and there may be more guidance that comes out of this. It seems very difficult that an employer can be held accountable for something that's outside of their control. We can't control, once it's with the software provider, you can't control when it goes to the fund, when it goes to the member's account, yet the burden is now on the employer and they're the ones responsible for it. They're the ones that will be penalised for it under the super guarantee regime. Little bit scary, I know. So that's it from the slides, but I did have a couple of other points I just wanted to touch on before we carry on. So there's also an issue for contractors. So traditionally, we understand we've got these rules, employee versus contractor. Some contractors attract super. In my experience, unless you're in a very large organisation with hundreds of employees, contractors are usually paid on a different basis to employees. So usually HR and payroll over there will manage employees. Contractors are usually dealt with by payables on an invoice basis, you know, when they come in. So is that also going to create issues with multiple cycles? So no longer have you also got payroll cycles once a week, and you've got payroll and you've got 7 days from payroll date to address those super. But if you're paying contractors on an invoice basis and maybe payroll's on a Monday and accounts payable's on a Thursday and payables is also including contractors, which require super, now you've got double superannuation deadlines. So it might be worthy for even your smaller guys is just to have a discussion around aligning contractor payments, those particularly that have superannuation attracted to it, to your payroll cycles, just to make sure that you're reducing the compliance burden that you're going to be having. The other thing that I'm conscious of is the timing for the holiday periods. So there is no concessions at current in the new legislation for holiday periods. Not like our BAS, you know, over Christmas we get extra time and extra processing time. And I wonder if with software providers, I mean, when will they do updates? Traditionally, all their updates and super funds, they do all of this over your Christmas breaks, your Easter breaks, those sorts of periods. Is there going to be a carve-out and a concession for holiday periods for lodging and reporting on super? I'd like to see it, but I don't think it's there yet. The other thing that I just wanted to touch on, and it's not necessarily related to super, but it's also something that's quite relevant at the moment, I just want everyone to be aware, is with the STP reporting. I mean, we've just all been through the years of transition for STP reporting. Now, the transition period for STP reporting ended on 30th of June last year. Now, has anyone in the room actually ever received a penalty or be penalised for not lodging their STP electronically? It was not actually something, it's under guidance at the moment with the ATO they're developing, and I think it's expected to be released this month. I'm not sure of that, but essentially setting out that non-lodgement of STP will attract full administration penalties. So if you have not lodged your STP for, I don't know, pay run last week, you will be subject to the same penalty regime as non-lodgement of BAS. I'm not sure whether this is going to apply retrospectively back to, say, last July when the transition period ended, but it's just really something to be mindful of. We do get the occasional small employer who just doesn't want to know about electronic reporting. They might be processing the payroll, they've done it all, and then they come to us at year end and they've got, I don't know, 52 pay runs overdue for filing. It's not that traditionally they haven't been penalised for that, but all of a sudden when these new rules come in, you might have clients and employers who are going to get stuck with very large penalties. Just to put it into perspective, I was having a look. So small employers for 28 days overdue for a lodgement, 1,050. For a significant global entity that misses a lodgement, it's 500 units and 525,000 for not reporting that STP. And they range sort of small, medium, in between. I just think it's something that we need to be making sure that our clients are aware of. It's sort of a little bit sneaky in the background. I talk to people, no one's sort of aware that this is out there. And I don't doubt that as soon as this is implemented, give it come July, agents will be receiving some nice little penalty notices for clients unbeknownst to them. So I do have 5 minutes for questions, Jackie, if there was any questions on this. So I've got through all of that in time. So were there any questions from anyone in the audience? We've got one over here. Do we have a mic?
Very simple question. That is, if you're a sole trader and you've got a couple of employees, and up until now you've been using the small business clearinghouse, and you're simply wanting to pay the super fund direct EFT or direct deposit, do you have to go into the trouble of getting?
You will, yes. So the days of your small guys and your super clearinghouse is gone. So you will need to have a software provider that can handle that with reporting. It's part of, I think, the preparation. I think the idea is the ATO wants it all electronically so they can data match and see all of that, which is understandable. I mean, I understand the regime and why it's there. There's plenty of people who are not adhering to superannuation, not paying superannuation on large forms. I think perhaps this legislation was brought out and perhaps a little bit hasty in the implementation, and a lot of things have not been thought about the practicality of it from a small business perspective, but it is going to create challenges for your small businesses. Were there any other questions? We've got one.
Okay, so now I just had to run out for a second. So if I'm duplicating a question, just forgive me. Now, in my experience and a lot of the clients that flow through, is it'd be really unusual for a payday to include that day in their pay period. So you made a point in the beginning of the presentation about how difficult it is to bring people in on the weekend to do book work because it pays on payday. But wouldn't it be more practical to end the pay period on a Tuesday or Wednesday but paid on Friday? It defers that worry and the extra cost over the weekend so that it wouldn't occur. That's the first question. And the second question is, hold on, I got to read my writing because I did it really quickly. I'm going to skip that one. Okay.
So, look, I think for most small businesses, 7 days, most small businesses would be adhering to that. I mean, they don't have huge complex payrolls. They'll run a payroll and that's fine. Most small businesses that I know usually, paying on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, and that's fine. I think it's probably for your medium and your large employers, particularly those that have such large volumes of payroll that they need to do multiple pay cycles. So a lot of the large employers are doing it in batches, so they do different divisions, different departments on this day in preparation for payday. Now it's 7 days from payday. So it doesn't matter. I mean, you can start preparing your payroll on a Monday. So let's say the pay period ends on a Sunday. You can start preparing your payroll. You can do it all week if payday is Friday, because then you get 7 days. So I think the idea is just that by putting it on a Friday, you essentially get an additional weekend. So for very large employers, it will reduce the risk of perhaps not meeting that. deadline if you do want to move it to a Friday. I'm not suggesting everyone run out and move their payrolls to Friday. I mean, it can cause all sorts of issues with employees and things like that. But if you are concerned, I mean, as well for a lot of people where they might have part-time payroll departments or things like that that work on certain days, you're just going to have to be mindful of all of that and start thinking about it. I think a lot of people as well use offshore payroll systems now and external, and so also that just needs to be taken into consideration. So it's really on a client by client basis, but we just need to be having these discussions with the client so they're aware.
Now there have been, or at least there is, a provision, if it's still in effect, where you could have a direct transfer into the super fund in a BPAY regime. You could pay your employee super that way.
Yes.
Do you think that with the diminishment of the clearinghouse the ATO erected some years ago, that you're going to see an increase in that?
I think that will be made obsolete. I think that's what this gentleman was saying. So for your small guys, sort of, you know, you might have mum, dad and, you know, a couple of the kids or a few employees. And so a lot of people do, they pay it direct into the super fund, or particularly, you know, where mum and dad might have a self-managed super fund, they just pay it straight over there, report it in the clearinghouse, no issues. The days of that, I think, are gone. So everyone will need to have complying software, and everyone will need to be reporting through a clearinghouse, and the direct method will disappear.
Okay, you made a note about, you said that if a contribution has been rejected, then when it comes back, you get 14 days to rectify that situation.
Yes.
That sure seems to me like that's a window of vulnerability that could be exploited.
Yes, I would agree with that. And so I have great concerns as to the return time frame. I think the return time frame says that the super needs to return it to 3 days. In my experience, a rejected contribution is usually about 5 to 6 weeks from the time that you submit it.
Well, that's close.
Yes, so it's very close to the 3-day mandate. So as I say, I do have concerns as to how that will be navigated, but I guess we'll find out more from the ATO as they develop that in the next few months, and hopefully there's a few concessions carved out there for this transition period.
Okay, my last two questions is the uplift, the 60% uplift on the lack of voluntary disclosure. Is there anything in the legislation to come that says where that money goes? Is it all going to go into the employee super fund?
Yeah. So not at the moment. So they have said that the new rules will be under the approved form. The approved form and the approved guidance is still under development. We're expecting that, I think, in the next 2 months. So we'll have more details of that coming up.
I can see a risk that it could be a money grab. But
yes.
Finally, the thing that I see as an overall trend in all of the things that everybody in this room is probably getting hit with today and yesterday is that it's an increasing emphasis by the government, that is government by fiat, that the government traditionally had certain duties towards its people, but that's not happening now. They're just deferring the duties into the private enterprise, and the penalties are still increasing. So it's becoming increasingly rigid, deadlines that the government itself cannot meet, but they're forcing private enterprise to do it with stricter guidelines, stricter deadlines, and yet the penalties are also increasing. Do you think that is some sort of a conflict in our expectations of the rule of government?
I'm perhaps not the one to answer that question. It's a very complex question. Look, I think I understand the reason why we brought in this regime. As I said, there's plenty of employers who are just blatantly not paying super. They're blatantly not doing it. And so there's a lot of employees that are missing out. It's important that we address it. I just don't think that they've perhaps consulted and they perhaps rushed it a little to get to bring this out and bring it to market. And there is a few things that are going to need to be addressed, because do I see it working seamlessly and smoothly? No, we're going to have a few issues over the transition. But yeah, we just have one more, and yeah, then I want to hand over.
Thanks, Jackie. Steve Lutz, thank you for that. The 7-day issue, I think, is just... Your last comment about that's clearly a lot of issues, practical issues arising out of this. And I don't think for a second that from 1 July every employer in Australia is going to comply with 7 days. given the tax office themselves appear to be closing their own clearinghouse, which I am very disappointed in, because this is the very time we would be relying on their massive infrastructure to help transition from the current system to this one. I can only implore the Tax Institute, where there is dialogue and advocacy in assisting with practical changes pre-30th of June, that the seven-day issue to me is just a significant one that I think is just going to be a thorn in everyone's side, including the administrators going forward, because of its impracticality across all employers in Australia. It's a comment.
I would agree with that. So, and look, the Tax Institute's being active in providing guidance. As I said, the last two tax fines have had quite comprehensive breakdown, and there's a two-part series on it. And on 10th of March, we're doing, I think it's a 1.5, two-hour webinar on this subject, so we hopefully might have more guidance and some more examples and things. So feel free to tune in if you would like to hear a bit more about that. So. Well, thank you, everyone, for that. I'd like to invite Jenny up onto the stage, Jenny from the ATO, and she's going to touch on some estate matters for us. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks, Billy, and thanks to the Tax Institute for the opportunity to speak today. I'm going to talk about a very topical issue that we're seeing, and no doubt you are seeing in your practices. We all know Australia is experiencing an unprecedented level of intergenerational wealth transfer at the moment, and succession planning has been a key focus area for the ATO for the last couple of years. The reason we're interested is if you look at the demographics, we've got about 271,000 privately owned and wealthy groups in Australia. They collectively control $4.4 million in assets. And when you look at the ageing demographics, we are seeing 4 out of 5 of the controllers of those groups are now over the age of 50. Through our engagements with private groups, we're seeing an increase in succession planning activities as groups plan for the sale of a family-owned business or for the transfer of wealth to the next generation. No doubt you're seeing elements of this within your own practices at the moment. I was a little tempted to leverage the HBO series Succession to illustrate some of the topics and things that we're seeing at the moment, but I recognise probably not everyone is familiar with that show. And when you think about it, probably some of those examples are not the examples that we want to encourage for private groups. So I thought I'd dial back a couple of decades and talk about a story that most of you should be familiar with, involving succession, family legacies, unforeseen life events, family disputes, and perhaps a little Disney magic. I'm talking about The Lion King. So I'm going to take you through some of the ATO focus areas and interest areas of interest for us through 5 key lessons. So lesson 1, like the circle of life, succession is inevitable and planning is critical. And we heard from Sally yesterday afternoon about all the different tax consequences that can arise on death. From an ATO perspective, our focus on succession planning doesn't just start with the retirement of a group head or their exit from a family business. It really is about the whole journey. So the decisions made and arrangements that a group might enter into over the life cycle of that private group. Succession planning can take place over many years, or it might be triggered by unforeseen circumstances, such as the death of a family member. On the slide there, there's just a couple of the key key typologies that we do see in succession planning. It can take shape, and of course, every group is different, so that's just a bit of a sample. The main typologies we do see are, you know, ownership and business succession, where the next generation might come in and take over the family business, That's what Mufasa had planned for Simba. Diversification and exit. Now, perhaps some of the tragedies in that movie could have been avoided if Mufasa and Scar's parents had given some thought to maybe we divide and conquer and perhaps share the lands and the ruling, the kingdom between the two brothers. Management succession, where the next generation want to stay involved, like want to retain some degree of control and influence over the business, but don't want to be involved in the day-to-day running. It may involve the establishment of a family office, so selling off some or all of the family business, putting that wealth into a family office and managing those investments, and estate planning, which is your pretty default land typology where the will dictate most of those wishes. We're seeing that the retirement age is getting later and later, and many controllers of these groups are wanting to stay involved in that the activities of the family business far beyond what typically used to be retirement age. But we do say it's never too early to put a plan in place, even if retirement's not yet on the cards. And it may become useful in case of unforeseen circumstances, which brings us to lesson number two, which is life happens, plans can change, and be prepared. In a rare moment of wisdom for Scar, he does tell his hyenas that when it comes to kings and successions, they need to be prepared. We know family norms have changed over the years and there's no longer that typical family unit. Family dynamics can shift with life events, births, deaths, marriages, divorce, adoption, blended families, family disputes, and family members living offshore. There's a couple of life events throughout The Lion King, but, most notably at the start where Scar says, well, I was next in line until that little hairball was born. And, of course, the tragic wildebeest stampede that was orchestrated by a vengeful brother. And that really disrupted some of Mufasa's plans. Now, in real life, it's perhaps not so dramatic, but certainly can be equally disruptive. So what does this mean? It means in terms of a plan, it is important that it's not just a set and forget exercise, but one that is reviewed regularly. When their life event changes, relationship breakdowns, or even if decisions are made around the direction a family business is going in. But what about that shadowy place? The place that Mufasa says, you must never go to. This is a tax conference, so we'll have a little bit of a chat about the tax risks that might be lurking in the graveyard. Succession planning strategies can involve a whole range of activities, restructures, asset realisation, wealth transfers, and even the use of some concessionally taxed vehicles, such as self-managed super funds. All of these can trigger potential taxing points. We are seeing some fairly unforeseen and significant tax consequences. We're seeing a number of private groups now experiencing and grappling with the unforeseen and fairly significant tax consequences of decisions that were made many years ago. We know that some of those decisions were not made for tax purposes, and even where they were made without thinking about the longer term effects of those decisions on tax for that group. I'm not going to delve into details, but family trust elections have been mentioned a few times over the last day and a half. We also know there's a number of elections in the tax law that can't be unwound or corrected or changed. And we heard yesterday there are some decisions you can't do once you are dead. The tax risks that we're focused on fall broadly into two categories. Compliance with the fundamentals. And then, of course, arrangements that appear a bit more complex that may start to attract the attention of Part 4A. In terms of the fundamentals, and I say fundamentals, I'm not saying these are simple. We've heard a lot in the last day or two around how complex some of these provisions are. But the most common one will be eligibility for small business CGT concessions. And I know John did a deep dive yesterday on just a small fraction of those provisions. Private groups and their wealth and turnover tend to fluctuate. So with growth, with market changes in market conditions, it's really important to keep an eye on those in terms of the various thresholds that apply to those concessions. The two that we see the most frequently are the small business entity test and the maximum net asset value test. As a bit of a sidebar, we do are seeing reporting issues with CGT. So transactions that we know have occurred and seen through our commercial deals programs not being reported on the income tax return, in terms of particularly including where exemptions and rollovers might have been claimed, and also where the CGT schedule itself has either not been completed or not been completed properly. A growing area we're seeing issues with is whether an asset continues to attract pre-CGT status. Most of our groups that we're seeing involve multi-generational family groups, very established groups that have assets that were purchased prior to the introduction of CGT in 1985. And it's quite easy to assume that just because the asset itself is over 41 years old, that the disposal of that might just by default be CGT free. The two key events that we're seeing at the moment is where CGT event K6 arises. So that might be where a trust and company that holds the pre-CGT asset now has more than 75% of post-CGT assets. So that's CGT, the pre-CGT asset status will disappear. And, of course, Division 149, where if there is a change in a majority underlying interests, it may apply and also result in loss of pre-CGT status. Now, in terms of K6, the ATO published an amendment to TR 2004-18 last year to clarify a few key principles. And in terms of Division 149, we are very aware that of the ART decision last year in XLZH, the ATO has appealed that, so we'll see what happens later this year. And this wouldn't be a presentation on, so no presentation on anything in the private wealth space, would be complete without a mention of Division 7A. Any of these asset transfers asset or wealth transfers involving a private company, we're seeing Division 7A not being considered or not being considered properly, so just a bit of a reminder to, you know, if you see a private company, imagine Zazu saying, have you thought about Div 7A? Most of those risks tend to be a result of, you know, inadvertent errors, omissions, or in some instances, inadequate tax governance. The other aspect that we are very interested in, of course, is those hyenas loitering in the shadowy place, where arrangements might attract Part 4A. We've heard a bit about Part 4A over the last couple of days as well in relation to purpose. So what will attract our attention are examples where there are intermediary steps, additional transactions that don't seem to have any other impact other than generating or creating the circumstances for which an exemption or rollover or concession might arise. And amongst the multiple factors in Part 4A, really looking at substance and form. Big one is where we're seeing multiple exemptions and rollovers. Now, we do recognise there's a lot of rollovers, a lot of exemptions out there. They apply in different scenarios and groups are free to use those for those purposes. What will catch our attention is where we see multiple exemptions and rollovers being claimed, particularly in quick succession. So year on year on year. And an example of this might be where a widely owned company is looking to purchase a business owned by a unit trust. That, if it was a direct share exchange, you won't get access to any of those concessions and rollovers. We have seen scenarios where the unit trust is now transferring to a private company owned by that same group, accessing 122N rollover relief. then transferring those shares from the private company through to the widely held company, and that, you know, creating an opportunity to access 122M. The ATO is looking to publish a practical compliance guideline on back-to-back rollover this year, and that will outline the various scenarios through which will be either high risk of compliance activity and attention or low risk. And that may be, we're still working through whether or not there might be a tax determination as well on some of the more substantive provisions. The other types of arrangements that we are seeing include, you know, restructures in order to access concessions or rollovers, or to prolong pre-CGT asset, pre-CGT status, other artificial or contrived arrangements, overly complex where they're circular. An example we've seen is a group transferring the wealth offshore to transfer to the next generation, only to see the funds slowly make their way back into Australia and back to that group. And we'll particularly be interested if there is an artificial increase in cost base or the cost of assets for capital allowance purpose on top of the accessing of those various concessions. So how do we avoid some of these risks? Hakuna Matata or no worries may be a good philosophy for meerkats and warthogs, but this attitude has no place when it comes to succession planning. Effective tax governance can help with mitigating tax risks, but it's not just about tax. I know in this space, and one reason succession planning is really interesting for me personally is there's a real human element to this. So, you know, a governance framework is not necessarily, it's not solely for tax, but can really help with the transition and continuity for a family group. From a tax perspective, what we're really interested in, we're not talking about justified trust level of tax governance that Neil talked about yesterday. You know, some of this is really, and a governance framework will vary from group to group depending on its size. But at its core, it's really around, have you got the right record keeping framework that enables that group to be able to substantiate its tax positions, to understand the decisions that have been made for that group that might impact on tax in the future, as well as any related party transactions. Really, we had the Full Federal Court decision in S&A Group last week, and while that appeal period is still open for that, it is a really good reminder that particularly when you're dealing with closely held groups, that the, you know, any decisions made and intentions around transactions, particularly if you're looking to claim deductions, etc., are documented objectively. We did update the tax governance guide for privately owned or wealthy groups last year with some more specific tips on succession planning. And the other angle of that is really around the importance of having access to the right advice. So you're all here, you're all dealing with private groups and their day-to-day activities. Hopefully you're all Rafikis and not Timon and Pumbaa. But we also know that private groups, particularly as they get larger, often get advice from multiple sources. So they might have a family office, there might be specialist advisors like SMSF advisors, or additional lawyers and accountants brought into the group. It's really important that as advisors you're aware of what other advice your clients are getting their advice from. What we can see sometimes is where the advice is not coordinated, that can result in fragmented decision making, inconsistent sort of tax outcomes, but also, you know, you might be finding yourself giving advice without the full context of what else that group might have done. And of course, it's important that the next generation is also getting, you know, will also have access to advice, whether it's the same advisors or access to advice that has been given, and getting their own advisors. Which brings us to lesson number 5, which is that the next generation needs to be prepared to take the throne. Preparing the next generation is really important, particularly in understanding whether their intentions are aligned with those of the founders. So do they want to continue running the family business? Will they want to just get out and sell and maybe pocket the proceeds? Do they want to step away from the day-to-day running of that business but retain some control over what's happening? Understanding that intention early can really help a group prepare for what might come next. We see, Simba's excitement at wanting to become king, and so Mufasa starts to train him quite early on some key principles of what it's like to run a kingdom. And if you've watched Lion King 2, you can start to see some of the benefits of that play out. We also see where, the kingdom falls into disarray, where Simba, when things happen quite suddenly, decides to run away. For the next generation, if I come back to tax, it's important to understand that for that next generation to understand the structures of that group, roles and responsibilities, their tax obligations, and access to documentation, records, etc. And, particularly when you talk about, we talked a lot about CGT, will they have access to the information they need to track the status of a CGT asset through? Acquisition dates, cost-based information, market value, copies of valuations, and trusts. We've heard a lot about trusts today. Trust copies of trust deeds, resolutions made, elections that have been made. So, in closing, probably just a couple of key wrap-up points. Life happens. And life is unpredictable, so please ensure encourage your groups, your client groups, to have a plan and to review it regularly, and to really think about the tax consequences, not just for now, but what it might mean into the future. Importance of having good record keeping and governance frameworks in place to try and mitigate and prevent those tax issues from arising. And seeking advice, whether it's from yourselves, specialist advisors, or the ATO. We do have a range of services. Some of you may be familiar with our commercial deals program. That's for post-transaction but pre-lodgement advice. We have an early engagement service that allows you to, reach out before you're contemplating a transaction, and, of course, the private rulings regime. And there's a range of material that we have on the ATO website. And so the last line I'll probably leave you with is, I'm going to quote Scar again, really it's about being prepared. So thank you for your time today. And I didn't think I'd finish early, but I appear to have a few minutes for questions.
With back-to-back rollovers, I've never quite understood why does the legislation in parts talk about a series of rollovers if you can't do it? I'm not saying that I would advise a client, to do a back-to-back rollover without serious consideration to Part 4A, but I've never really understood the ATO's view as to why, when you look at some of the particularly just the cost-based rules on rollover in the CGT, they implicitly think that you might do back-to-back rollovers?
Yeah. So we're not saying all back-to-back rollovers are bad. Obviously, there are commercial reasons for why particular transactions will take place. And if, as a matter of course, those rollovers arise or there's eligibility for those, so be it. When it comes to Part 4A, it really comes back down to purpose. So are steps being put in place to access rollover concessions that might otherwise not be available if you went straight from A to B that you might not get? So it's your classic Part 4A considerations rather than a blanket ban. The reason we're publishing some guidance is we just don't want people falling into the trap of thinking that they're all okay without awareness of potential application of Part 4A.
I'm not advocating them, but I just thought the policy of script for script was, when you went back down to the policy of it, was it was trying to do encourage people to do a commercial bargain where they didn't have the cash, and the government policy was we recognise that there is good transactions that would help the market and the economy if we allowed a cash and scrip sort of transaction. Your presentation was great. I'm not, but sometimes I feel the ATO doesn't understand that middle market, it's a very different regime from sort of the big end of town where they're already set up with companies. And in order to get someone to buy a large group, there may be no cash. And it just may be that you're not going to be able to sell. You're not there's a spectrum of families. Some people have really good kids, but you're always going to have a mix of people who, and you had it on the slide, people who just want to be shareholders and people who want to run the business.
Yep.
And often tax is the last thing. It's just that it's more like you got to try and see how you can break up the business. And I don't, will that guidance sort of take, you know, some, except that middle market is slightly different from the big end of town, and that it is these other considerations that sort of make people think to do?
So the guidance is being developed by a private wealth area, so it is focused primarily on that middle market private group setting, and we do recognise that, you know, they are different to the large end of town. And even within the private groups and demographics, you know, we've got very small groups that are just bigger than a small business in our definition, right through to our top 500 groups that are almost as big as. So we do take all of that into consideration. The PCG, I believe, will be issued in draft for consultation as well. So we will be seeking feedback. I think that's it. I can't see very far, though. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you so much to Bruce, Billy and Jenny for their presentations. Just a reminder to please fill out the evaluations in the attendee hub. And Amanda, would really, from the Tax Institute, would love to get a group shot of all of us. Where do you want us, Amanda? Out where we're going to have lunch. So she will corral everyone once we go out there. So if everyone could just, pop out there, and then we'll have some lunch, and then we'll be back for session 10 on payroll tax risks after lunch. Thank you.